Welcome to another episode of the One For You podcast. In this episode, we'll be discussing two very different films, but they have one thing in common. They're both directed by women. Ain't that Woo. Something? Woo-woo. And also they're both American, but the other thing is more exciting. The new release is The Old Guard and the gem is Certain Women. My name is Olivia Chonameo and I'm joined today by Alan Motley. Alan, welcome.
Hi, good to be back.
Yes, thank you for agreeing to join the podcast on a semi-regular basis. You always bring very interesting films that I wouldn't have watched otherwise. So, you know, it's a plus for me and definitely also for the listeners, I would say.
Very happy to have that reputation and to foist my, my current obsessions onto you and the listeners.
Welcome it. Thank you. And you bring a very specific skill set to the podcast today because of all the people who have been on the podcast, including me, you're actually the only one who's been to the cinema in this new post-lockdown current coronavirus situation. So, Alan, tell us, what is it like to go to the cinema now?
Well, it's weird in one respect because I've both been to regular screenings and to press screenings. And I think generally it's the first time in a long time that the press screenings are more crowded than the regular screenings, which feels very new. And which gives me the impression that it's a good thing to wear a protective mask in the cinema. What is it like? There is this sort of anxiety when you are like sitting in a row in front of a few other people and they don't wear a mask and they talk very loudly and you have this acute sense that they might be spitting into your neck any minute now. But other than that, it is nice to be back at the cinema, and I think I would welcome if everybody just wore a mask so no neck spitting is going on. But I think it's not much different than other things that we are doing these days. It's just everything has this extra layer of COVID anxiety.
Yeah, definitely. Right there, I think the Pate chain has said now that they require people to wear masks, but the other cinemas haven't, right?
Yeah, I think with Pate, it's that they wanted to have a requirement generally, and then they kind of walked it back, and now it's an implicit requirement in the lobby, but not in the actual cinemas, which with the current cinema-goer numbers is probably something that is probably okay. I'm not sure, I'm not an epidemiologist, but I think it wouldn't be... Like having a mask requirement generally wouldn't be the worst thing for cinemas because it might also help counteract the anxiety generally. But I don't know, maybe that's just me.
No, I mean, that's why I haven't gone to the cinema yet because I feel like you're in this enclosed space and it's dark and, you know, you hear someone going like, and then you're like, oh my God, we're all going to die, right? So yeah. I haven't really, I also don't see myself going soon. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, maybe I'll give it a shot or, you know, try, like Monsi suggested last time, like the open-air cinema or something at Xenix, you know.
Oh, yeah. And then there's also the drive-in cinemas coming up.
Yes, but I don't have a car, so that's difficult for me.
Steal your parents' car. I can't even drive.
It's true. I do have that advantage. Yeah. But so mostly I'm just watching films at home, so which means I'm doing a lot of rewatching films that I've already seen. You know, then you have the additional layer of comfort. So I rewatched Ocean's 8 the other day. You know, I'm a big fan of the Ocean's films. So I rewatched this one. And, you know, it's good, but I think it's missing, like, the whole coolness level, I think, that especially Ocean's 11 has, which I don't know why, because there's lots of cool people in there, you know, like Sandra Bullock, Kate Blanchett, Rihanna, and all the others. I don't know, maybe it's because Steven Soderbergh isn't directing the film or something. I don't know. Maybe. But it's lacking a bit of pizzazz. So, but it's still good. So I rewatched it. So
I should finally rewatch 12 and 13 because, like, I didn't like them when I first saw them in the mid to late 2000s. And to this day, I am a huge fan of Ocean's 11, and I like Ocean's 8, but the other two, I'm always just like, they also exist, I guess. But I was also a very stupid teenager when I first saw them, so who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I rewatched all of them in preparation for Ocean's 8 when it came out, like, whenever it came out. And Ocean's 11 is clearly the best, but I think the others also have redeeming features, especially Ocean's 13. So, you know, if you ever get done with your Werner Herzog retrospective, maybe that's something you want to jump into.
I counted yesterday, it's like 15 films to go.
How many have you already watched?
Well, he has made 67, and one of them never saw the light of day, so 66 minus 15, so it's got to be 51.
Oh my god.
I mean, a lot of them are like also documentaries that are 40 minutes long.
But yeah, still. But still, that's a commitment, Ellen. I am super impressed. Okay. Yeah, you can always come back. Like, every time you come back in the podcast, you tell us how far you've gotten and like what you're, if you're being haunted by his voice or something.
I mean, I did watch Family Romance LLC, his latest one, on Mubi the other day, and this has a 5-minute introduction by him and a 10-minute Q&A with him afterwards, so I was in heaven. So I'm like, I can probably hear his beautifully accented English in my dreams now. So if that's haunting, then I'm fine with it.
You're fine with it. Okay, cool. All right, let's get into it. Let's talk about our new release. No worries. As always, when we discuss the new release, there are no spoilers. We'll make sure that you won't be spoiled. So the new release is The Old Guard, which is a Netflix film that came out on Friday. And it's directed by Gina Prince-Bythewood, who also directed films such as The Secret Life of Bees. And I think is probably still most famous for Love and Basketball, which I watched way back when. I mean, that was 2000. I was very young when I watched it, but it left an impression. I still remember it. And the film is based on a series of graphic novels by the same name, The Old Guard. And Greg Rucka adapted, his own graphic novels, basically. And it's basically, The Old Guard refers to this group of immortal warriors who are led by Andy, who's played by Charlize Theron. We're going with Theron. I don't know. If you pronounce the name differently, let us know. and basically, for centuries, they have gone wherever they are needed. And in this moment, a new immortal warrior rises, a young woman named Nile. And she's played by Kiki Layne. But in today's world, it's very difficult to stay hidden, you know, cameras and selfies and whatnot everywhere. And so their unique properties, i.e. immortality, make them targets, basically, in this new world. So, Alan, I can only say I am here for this film. I enjoyed it so, so much. What did you think?
I also enjoyed it. I watched it last night and started at like 11:30 p.m. I had a great time. I'm finding myself increasingly, like, not disillusioned, but kind of bored with superhero movies or movies that are in the superhero mode, even though I still watch all of them. So this felt like a breath of fresh air to me.
Yeah. People would say maybe like it's genre-wise, it's like maybe an action film. But what I really, really liked about it is that it makes you invest in the characters. You care about these characters.
So much.
Right? Like a lot of it is about, you know, how they relate to each other and what being immortal, you know, and living all these centuries has done to them. Mm-hmm. I love that the film takes the time to really flesh that out and for them to have like conversations.
Yeah, it's very quiet, even though like you have these intermittent action scenes that are like bone crunching action and kind of the John Wick mode-ish, I'd say. Slightly less polished, slightly more, like, dirty. I really appreciated that quiet aspect of the film as well. Because, yeah, if I were asked to name a problem that I have with action films in general and, like, superhero-ish films in particular, it's like that the characters are just kind of taken for granted. It's like you have these however many people you have, and then you know what they can do, and that's like maybe one trauma per person, and that's it, and then you just send them off fighting. And here it's really all about how they deal differently with their abilities, as you say, how they relate to each other. how they look at the world from their unique perspectives, etc., etc. So I think it's this added a nice layer of emotional investment.
Yes, definitely. So I think, like, for instance, the fact that Nile, you know, she's like a woman of the 21st century, and you can tell that she relates to all of this different than like warriors from past centuries would have. And, you know, she's also new to this whole situation, and you can really tell the difference. And you know what's amazing? That I know all of their names, right? Because so often at the end, you're like, oh, it's that guy. But I know all of their names because I care about all of them. So you have, like we said, Andy and Nile. And you have, for instance, Joey and Nikki, who are like two immortal warriors who have been in love for, I don't know, a millennium. And it's so sweet.
It's like, yeah, that's the greatest meet cute. You kill each other during the Crusades, and then you find out that you're immortal, and then you also find out that you're immortally in love with each other.
It's amazing. I love it. And like that, that's so much focus is put on that. And I also like that they're the only couple in the film, right? Yes. So it's not like, oh yeah, we also have like a queer couple, but like they're like the beating heart of the film in some ways. And I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and that also helps with the emotional investment, not just in the characters, but also in the story. Not to spoil anything, but there are moments where you do go like, no, please, I hope they're going to be okay.
Oh, yes. I was like, if you like touch a hair on their head, I will come for you. Yeah, so like you have that sweet relationship, and then you have, they're played, we should say, Joe is played by Marwan Kenzari, and Nikki is played by Luca Marinelli. And you have Matthias Schön, how do you say his name?
Schönart? I'm Schönart, I think. Okay. Yeah, I'm not a Flemish scholar.
Okay, Matthias Schönart, who plays Booker, and he has a very different outlook on this whole situation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's that's cool. And also we have Tuatel Egeofor, who's like a guy who hires them to do a job for him. And I got major, like when I saw him for the first time, I was like, he's like major operative vibes for those people who are familiar with, you know, the film Serenity. I was like, uh-oh, that's going to be interesting.
I enjoy watching Chiwetel Ejiofor because he brings very different energies to different roles. And here it's always like a little, like he's a bit of an ambivalent character, but then also he just seems, he has this weird balance between being in charge and just being way in over his head.
Yeah, definitely.
And let's not forget that Harry Melling is also in there, who is Dudley Dursley.
Oh my god, I did not recognize him.
You did not? He is the main villain.
Yes, he is. Now that you're saying it. Oh my god, yes. You know why? Because he wasn't fat. Then I would have recognized him if he had worn a fat suit.
I'm so happy that this guy has a career, because I think he's pretty good.
Yeah.
I enjoy watching him.
Very slimy and annoying. And I feel like that was what he was supposed to be. So yeah, well done you.
And he's wearing a great suit jacket hoodie combo.
Look at me. I'm the CEO of the super cool startup. I hate you already. Oh my God. Mind blown. I did not realize that. Yeah. But anyway, I'm really super hoping that they will make a sequel, because I think there's so much to explore still here.
There's a lot to explore. And also it's a very good sign that when the movie ended, I wasn't like, okay, now we're done with that. I was like, I could see myself watching a sequel. Please give me a sequel.
Please give us a sequel. And I was already while I was watching the film, I was like, I will rewatch this film. This is one of those films, you know, where you're like, you can watch it over and over again because you care and you're invested in the characters. So I think they did a really good job.
Yeah. And I said, fuck yeah, a bunch, which is always good.
That is always a good sign, right? Yes, totally. I agree with that. So I would say the old guard is definitely one for us, right?
Yes, agreed.
Agreed. Okay. That brings us to the gem session. As always, there will be spoilers in the gem session. So if you don't want to hear about certain women, not certain women, that's the title, sorry, now is the moment to stop. Alan, take it away.
Certain Women is a film by Kelly Reichardt, who is an American director. I think this is her fifth film, which came out, it came out in 2016, and it's, as the title suggests, about certain women. More specifically, four women. Is it four women? I always forget. Yes. Played by Laura Dern, Michelle Williams, Kristen Stewart, and Lily Gladstone. And they are women of different backgrounds in rural Montana. And yeah, it's basically short stories from their lives. And I'm using the word or the term short stories very deliberately here because it is based on a short story collection by Mel Malloy. Yeah, and I think that's about it in terms of plot. Do you have anything to add?
Just that Mel Malloy is an excellent name, I have to say.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like you said, it's like these three stories that are distinct. So it's not a type of like Love Actually thing. I mean, there are some small connections, but it's not like coming together into a whole thing. It's like, right? Really like if you were reading as if you were reading a short story collection and you have these three stories, one after the other. And there isn't even like, you know, a title card or anything to signal that we're in a new story now. You're just like, you see someone and you can't really see who they are. So it takes you a moment to figure out that you are now in a new story, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's how they're put together. Except, so I thought it was just going to be like story A, B, C. But then at the end, you go back to every story for like one last, I don't know, moment.
Glimpse at,
So why did you think they did that?
I don't know. Maybe because if you don't do that, maybe there is a sort of feeling that it should have been three distinct short films and not a feature film. And like that, you kind of thematically connect them a little bit to each other.
Yeah, but maybe. I mean, they don't interact or anything, so it's still... No.
I think it's kind of like juxtaposing or just putting against or next to each other the three outcomes of these three different stories and just... trusting in the viewer to make their own connections. I don't know. I feel that's a thing that Kelly Reichardt does in general. She thinks of her films as smaller stories embedded into larger stories that we only ever see very marginally. And that she thinks that the smaller stories can tell us something about the larger story. And I think this is, in certain women, this is kind of the case because you have like this with Michelle Williams, you have this larger story of maybe marital disintegration. And then in the end, you still have this image of her smoking apart from the other people. And then there is this sort of impression of loneliness, even though she is with a group of people who ostensibly love her a lot. Then you have Lily Gladstone, who is just the loneliest person you could imagine. With like her love story with the Kristen Stewart character that doesn't come to pass. And then you also have Laura Dern trying to, I don't know, bridge that gap between her professional life and her personal life and trying to be, I don't even know what she's trying to be. It's just like this, see, that's the thing with Kelly Reichardt. It's very evocative, but it's very difficult to put into words what exactly the movie tries to make you feel or tries to make you think. It just kind of puts it out there and then you're basically left to your own devices.
Maybe we should say something quickly about the story anyway. I was just thinking, so Laura Dern plays Laura, who's a lawyer, and she has this client played by Jared Harris, who, you know, basically his case isn't going anywhere, but he can't, you know, come to terms with that, so he keeps coming back to her. And then eventually there's a little hostage situation.
And emphasis on the little.
Right? It's very understated, right? Mm-hmm. There's like no sirens and it's all very calm. And then she has to go in and talk him down. She tries to talk him down. But it's not like in any way like an action film or anything. It's very, very calm. Gina, who's played by Michelle Williams, like you said, there's like marital problems because her husband is Laura's lover. That's never, the connection isn't explored, it's just presented to us. But they're sort of trying to maybe cover that up by building a house together. that they're doing. And then Lily Gladstone's character, I think she doesn't have a name. I think she's just called the Rancher in like everything that I've seen. And
her the DVD subtitles call her Jamie for some reason.
Jamie. Okay.
I don't know. Maybe that's from the short story. Who knows?
Okay. Yes. So her, she helps a rancher with like the horses. And she sort of falls for Kristen Stewart's teacher character. But it doesn't go anywhere because like these are very depressing stories in a way. I would say like it's very hopeless in a way. I don't know.
I don't know if I would call it hopeless, but very bleak and melancholy, definitely.
Yes.
And it's also like, yeah, but I agree with the sentiment, if not with the term depressing. But yeah, I mean, my own Letterboxd review after, like, I've seen this film like 4 times now, and my Letterboxd review was basically amounted to, it's 1,000 little heartbreaks over the course of 100 minutes. And then in the end, when you have kind of the most emphatically brutal heartbreak of them all with Lily Gladstone trying to chat up Kristen Stewart's character and Kristen Stewart's character maybe getting it, but also maybe not, and just then walking away, that it just all kind of comes crashing down on you.
That was so harsh, man.
Yeah.
That was really brutal. Yeah. I mean, like, bleak, I think, is also sort of reflected in the visuals, right? So there's a lot of brown and beige and a lot of sort of open and empty surfaces and landscapes that you have both. And it almost sometimes looks like a painting. I think there's one scene in Laura Dern's story. So that's the first one. I think she's sitting on the bed, but we can't see her directly. We see her in the mirror and you see like the gray or beige or brown or whatever wall. And it really like, and it's very still, and it looks like a painting. Like you could imagine this is a distinctly American painting.
Oh yeah, it's like the Edward Hopper connection is definitely in there.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very, it's also very American. There's a lot of driving and contemplating stuff while driving, right?
Yep.
There's so much driving.
So much driving.
Yeah. And it's a very naturalistic film. So it's very, in a way that I talk, and it's also a very quiet film, I would say.
That's something that happens a lot in Kelly Reichardt's films. She's another director whom I've dedicated a personal retrospective to. So I've been rewatching several of her films lately. And yeah, with a naturalistic dialogue, there's always these dialogues and these exchanges that seem to circle around a certain point but never quite get there. And again, this is another instance where she just leaves the audience to finish connecting the dots at the end, and you always just get these very sparse pieces of dialogue that are kind of floating in space and never actually reaching their designated point, it seems, which I think is a very evocative way of telling that story.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, yes. But it's not like confusing or anything. It's
no, not
I
at
think
all.
It's also not super, it's not hard to interpret. You know, it's like what you said with the situation between Kristen Stewart's character and Lily Gladstone's character. So maybe there's ambiguity in there because nobody says outright what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But you can understand what's going on without it being explained to you, you know, with the syllables. We're like, yes, and now this is happening and this is happening, right? So, yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe this is just because I had expectations, but the film is called Certain Women.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, like, okay, you have these main characters, and I would actually say there are 3 main characters because I think Kristen Stewart's character is a secondary character, but I guess this is open to interpretation. Apart from the last story, does this film doesn't pass the Bechdel test necessarily, I think, because it's always, you know, conversations with men, usually. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in the first story, like Laura Dern's story.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's 2 other background female characters, and the important characters are all men other than her. In Gina/Michelle Williams' story, the same. You know, there's her daughter, and that's like maybe too many conversations that they have. and the rest is with her husband or with, what's his name, René...
Auberginois.
Yes, that one. Right? So...
Yeah.
And especially in the first one, the whole story is driven not by Laura, who's in a way a passive character there, but driven by her clients, by Jared mm-hmm. Harris and what he's doing. And she has just to react to what's going on. So I don't know, maybe the story was making a point about something or, you know,
I think that in the first story, you kind of get that, like the gender relations part where Laura says, it would be just so nice if I were a man, I could just say that. And then they would say, the clients would say, okay, and it's done. And you can. And I think that story kind of plays on that with nobody ever really listens to Laura. She just, as you say, she basically just goes along with what the other men tell her. Also, like the policeman, when she goes to the hostage situation, she repeatedly like makes points and tries to say things, and nobody ever listens to her. So I think there, at least, it's the gender subtext is kind of there. And then in the second story with Gina, I think it's interesting that she's on the surface, she's presented as kind of an unlikable person because she, by regular movie-going standards, she's, you know, all of those things that sexists like to like to say about women. She's pushy, she's naggy in huge quotation marks, she's kind of hostile to her, as we know, unfaithful husband. And I think the second story kind of tries to turn that around by giving her at least a certain degree of three-dimensionality by showing that she is not just, like, she is not quote-unquote unlikable because she's just a bore or she's just a nag, but because she is frustrated with the way things are going, and that the way things are going are tied to her dysfunctional marriage.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I don't think that the film per se is sexist or anything. Just saying, like, even films that are about women.
Yeah.
You know, then there's so few women in there, and still you think, wow, they have like three main characters and they're all women. But in the end, you know, it's almost still like the one Smurfette principle, right? So
yeah.
So it's just something that I became aware of as I was watching the film. I don't think definitely. It's like a major problem or anything. I just, you know, thought because I don't know, like I haven't read anything by Mail Malloy. So, but it sort of evoked in me like a memory of Alice Munro's short stories, I think, that have a similar theme going on. Yeah. And it also sort of reminded me, maybe for me, I think this would have worked better as a short story in the written sense, because I feel like in writing you have more possibilities of interiority, right? And not a lot. Yeah. So you have a lot that's on the page, even if not a lot, let's say, happens in terms of outside stuff, action, if you want to. So, yes. So I think I would have preferred reading those stories rather than seeing them on the screen.
Yeah.
I have to say, for me personally.
Short stories are kind of Kelly Reichardt's forte because she's collaborated with another short story writer, John Raymond, several times, like in Old Joy and Wendy and Lucy, which are both very good films, which I would also recommend to you. And also on the whole Bechdel test topic, there's also Meek's Cutoff, which is a Western by Kelly Reichardt, which sort of has the same issues, if you want to call them that, as Certain Women, in that the women are basically just strung along by the men. But there it's that the men are getting lost in the American West during frontier times, and it's the women who are obligated to just follow along. And as the movie goes along, you start seeing the conversations they have with each other about the men who are useless, basically. which I think is an interesting spin on that theme.
Mm-hmm. And also genre-wise, because still not a lot of Western where women are in the center, I guess. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so Certain Women is one for you, I'm guessing.
It is. It was on my top 10 of the 2010s. So.
Yeah. Okay. Definitely. For me, I think it was probably more one-time thing. But I would be interested in sort of to see Meek's cutoff, because I think that might be interesting. Yes.
Okay. I can lend you the DVD.
Yes. Do that. Okay, so before we end this particular episode of the One For You podcast, let's discuss what we're looking forward to. Alan, do you want to start?
Yes, for me, it's just more Kelly Reichardt as I go on. Her latest film, which is called First Cow, came out on VOD yesterday, and it's about, as the title suggests, the first cow in the Northwest Territories of America in the, I think, 1820s, and about a Chinese immigrant and I think a trapper who secretly milked that cow and started selling cakes to great profit. And I've been looking forward to this movie ever since I first heard about it last year.
Okay, that story sounds insane.
Yeah.
First Cow for Ellen. Okay, got it. I'm looking forward to Fiancé, which is a documentary by Swiss filmmaker Julia Bündner. It's about three women in Cairo who are getting ready to marry. So you have an actor who wants to finally have her own apartment away from her family. You have a Christian woman who wants to have sex but also use contraception. And a woman who's from a rather conservative Muslim family who insists on equality. And, you know, I like documentaries a lot. And I think, you know, topic-wise, this is also right up my alley. So let's see what happens with that. And that's coming out, probably Thursday when you're listening to this. Okay. And that was it for this episode of the One For You podcast. Alan, thank you very much for joining me.
Anytime.
In the next episode, I'll be joined by Astrid Abasi, and we'll talk about the Nigerian film Nimbe and the classic animation Persepolis. To keep up to date with the podcast, follow us on social media, including Letterboxd, where we're at One For You Pod. Hear you next time.
Bye.
Bye.